Luke chapter 16. Luke chapter 16. We've been talking about the home, to have a family and a faithful family. Before we get to our text, I want you to imagine a husband and wife, we'll just say David and Susie, sitting down at the kitchen table, maybe at a Friday evening. They have their calculator, a stack of bills, and a lot of anxiety. And some of you say, I don't have to imagine that much. Susie looks at the spreadsheet and she just kind of sighs. Dave, we have a serious problem, she said. Our take-home pay this month is $4,000, but our bills are over $6,000. She said, we're deeply in the red. Now, Dave confidently folds his hands behind his back. He leans back in his chair and he says, don't worry, honey. I've already had an emergency committee meeting in the garage, and I've already solved this crisis. Well, Susie looks relieved. She says, what? I can't believe it. What'd you figure out to cut our expenses? He said, cut our expenses? Are you kidding me? Don't be ridiculous. I simply passed a continuing resolution to authorize $8,000 in spending. Crisis averted. Now, Susie doesn't really understand this. She's kind of rubbing her head, trying to figure it out. Dave, that doesn't make any sense. Where is that extra $4,000 coming from? Dave said, I'm so glad you asked. He said, first, I issued some short-term treasury bonds to our six-year-old. And then I raided his piggy bank. I took out his birthday money and replaced it with a post-it note that says, I owe you $45 payable in 2055. And he says, don't worry, he can't read yet. And so the optics are fine. We're good. He said, you stole from our child? Or she said, you stole from our child? And he said, oh, I prefer the phrase quantitative easing instead. Now, regarding the rest of the shortfall, he said, I took a hard look at our maxed out credit cards, and I made a really tough bipartisan executive decision with myself. I voted to raise our personal debt ceiling. We can now borrow up to $250,000. Now, Susie would be staring at him in absolute horror. And she glances back at the budget spreadsheet. She says, now, wait a minute. What is this $1,200 line item under the grocery budget for essential recreation infrastructure? Well, at that moment is when Dave, he has to fess up. He says, that's a new set of golf clubs. I had to attach it as a pork barrel rider to the grocery bill. Otherwise, the whole budget would have stalled and we'd be facing total household shutdown. I mean, we don't want to default on milk, do we? You know, when we apply government accounting to our personal lives, it instantly sounds like a comedy sketch, doesn't it? We immediately recognize how disastrous, unsustainable, and irresponsible it is to manage resources that way. Yet when it comes to the resources that God has entrusted to us, things like our time and our treasure, our talents, we sometimes act like Congress. We think that there's zero accountability and unlimited credit and no long-term consequences. But the Bible sets a very distinctly different standard for how we manage the resources and the assets that God has placed in our hands. Tonight I want to talk about a subject that touches every home and every person represented in our church tonight. Now we've been walking through God's design for the family in this series, and no family can honestly skip over managing money. If you ask any pastor, any counselor, or any husband or wife who's weathered a difficult season, you'll find out that financial pressures are one of the most common sources of strain and friction in a family. When the checkbook is in chaos, when the goes intos and the goes outs don't meet right, everybody feels it. The children can sense it. The marriage feels it. You feel it deeply yourself. You know, I had someone tell me, "You talk too much about money, preacher." I'm going to tell you, I don't think the Lord thought that he was speaking too much about money. Jesus said more about money and possessions than he said about heaven and hell combined. In 16 of his parables, he touches on it. Why? Because I think the Lord knew that nothing reveals the true condition of the heart like the way a person handles the resources, the assets, the money that God has laid in their responsibility. So let's go and look at our text. It is Luke 16. I want to look at verses 10 through 13. "He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. If therefore ye have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? And if ye have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. Ye cannot serve God and mammon." When we talk about asset management, we talk about the word stewardship. I think stewardship, you only hear that in church. No one really uses that outside of church, but it's a good Bible word. It's really kind of a compound idea. The first one is the word we use for house, okay? And the second one is kind of the word we use for law. And when you put them together, it's this idea of an orderly house. And so a steward is someone that is ordering their house, ordering their master's house. It's not their house. You know, the word, if we were to transliterate it, which simply means if you take it from Greek and put it right into English, it's the word we get economy from. And so every household has an economy. Tonight I want to look at, what time is it? I'm deciding how many of them we'll get through. This might be a two-part series. I have 6 points. We may only get through the first 3 or 4. We'll see. If it looks like you're all bored, we'll just nail all 6 of them and move on, all right? But the first thing I want you to see when we talk about stewardship is a thing that you always have to go over first. You already know what I'm going to say, and that is this: the right foundation. God owns it all. Psalm 24:1. "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein." Everything begins right there at the very beginning. I'm going to be giving you a lot of verses tonight, kind of like just a fire hose. If you want to write those down and look at them a little bit more later, that'd be great. I'm not going to go into great detail in any of them, but I want to bring these things forward to your remembrance. But before you talk about budgets, before we even talk about giving, before we talk about stewardship, really what we have to understand is that we are stewards, that everything that we have belongs to God. Haggai 2:8 says, "The silver is mine, the gold is mine." Now, that's not Haggai saying that. The rest of that verse says, "Saith the Lord of hosts," Haggai 2:8. In Psalm 50:10, the Bible says, "For every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon 1,000 hills. And people say, "Well, listen, I go out, I work hard, I work for my paycheck, I get paid, and the things that I earn are the things that I have worked for." And you know what God says? He says in Deuteronomy 8:18, "But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth." That strength that you have to get up in the morning to go out and work your job comes from God. And so even the ability to work is a blessing and a gift from God. If God owns it all, the question in family finances is not so much how much of my money am I going to give to God? It's really, how am I going to manage the money that God has entrusted to me? 1 Corinthians 4:2 is a very familiar stewardship verse because it reminds us of our responsibility to be faithful. Moreover, it is required in stewards that a man be found faithful. That's the one requirement that God insists on for an asset manager. If you found out that you had a 401k or an IRA at some place like Edward Jones or Charles Schwab or someplace like that, and you saw on the front page that your guy, your finance guy, was arrested for embezzling money, you'd be pretty nervous. How many of you are going to cut another check and send it to him? Nobody's going to do that. You say, he's an unfaithful steward of my money. I'm not going to give him any more opportunity to squander my money on things that I did not tell him to spend it on. God's looking at you the same way. Can she be trusted to manage the assets that I've entrusted to them? I believe that a family on a modest income can be more pleasing to God than a millionaire when they are faithful with what he has entrusted them. We had to sit down with our kids. I was thinking about this afternoon. And just go through, you know, that car? That's God's. This house belongs to God. And they're fine with that until you get to their room. And you're like, you know what? That belongs to God. That's why we don't leave it on the floor. That's why we take care of our things. If it were yours, you could wreck it, but nothing is yours. You have to start with the right foundation. God owns it all. And I think we know that intellectually, but when we really start looking at the things that are in our closet, the things that are in our pantry, the things that are in our garage, and we say, I don't own any of it. No, I don't own any of it. It all belongs to God. That opens up a whole new door of thinking then. Well, if it belongs to God, how does he want it used? How does he want it cared for? How does he want me to invest what he's given me or to spend what he's given me? It's a different mindset. And that ought to be the Christian's mindset. We start with the idea that everything belongs to God. I hope you believe that, but I hope it's more than just an intellectual understanding. I hope it's a heartfelt truth in your soul. All right, so that's the right foundation. God owns it all. I want to give you the right priority, and that is God comes first. Proverbs 3, 9, and 10 says, honor the Lord with thy substance and with thy first fruits, all of thine increase, so shall thy barns be filled with plenty, and thy presses shall burst out with new wine. And I told that guy I was not going to preach health and wealth prosperity gospel. I mean, this is it right here, all right? You give to God, he's got to give back to you. I don't think that's necessarily what it's saying, but it is saying that the principle is God comes first, and he does honor faith, okay? If God owns it all, then God has to come first. Notice the word in Proverbs 3, 9 and 10, first fruits. Do you like leftovers? Some people do. Depends what it is. I probably told this story. We know, when Missy and I were a young couple, we had been married just a couple years, went over a couple's house, and they're sitting there telling us how they go out to eat all the time. And this house was, I think it was in Brentwood, Tennessee. It was very expensive. I don't remember exactly where it was, but very nice house. And they said it was cheaper for them to eat out every night than to eat at home. And my wife and I both looked at each other and said, you are crazy. I mean, they had this nice, beautiful Thanksgiving meal, whatever it was very lavish. And at the end of the meal, we were helping to clean the table, and she was just in there putting everything in the trash can. I got so sick. I thought, I was almost so rude to say, I'll just take the trash can home. I couldn't believe it. I knew, I then understood why it was cheaper for them to eat out, because everything they made that they didn't eat just went in the trash can. I've never met anybody that hated leftovers that much, okay? But I think with that mentality, sometimes that's what we want to serve God, is our cold leftovers, and whatever's left we'll give to him. And I'm going to tell you, when you when you put first things first, then you have the opportunity to get everything in order. Doesn't mean we always will, but it means we have that opportunity to get everything in order. When you put first things last, you cannot get anything in the right order. Financially, do you understand what I'm saying? It has to come first. Malachi 3:6, God issues the only invitation in Scripture to put him to the test. He says, bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I've had people say, listen, I can't afford to give. My thought is, I can't afford not to. I remember R.B. Ouellette, we had him a few years ago. Many of you know who he is. He was preaching one time, and he was just waxing eloquent, and he just said, everybody tithes. And I thought, what? He said, everybody tithes. Of course, he said it the only way he could say it, right? But he said this, some people are smart enough to tithe to the Lord. Other people are foolish, and they tithe to the plumber and to the mechanic and to the whatever repair shop. And what he was saying was, oftentimes, the Lord blesses that faithfulness and has more money at the end of the month than you would have if you were not faithful in giving. Now, I believe that the tithe is really an Old Testament principle. In the New Testament, it talks about tithing mint and cumin and things, and Jesus said, you're right to do those things. But every time you see tithing in the New Testament, or excuse me, giving in the New Testament, it's not restricted to the tithe. As a matter of fact, it talks about not doing it compulsory. To me, the tithe is like a tax. It's compulsory. But listen, that's a good place to start. 10% is a great place for the new believer to start giving. But really, he says, from the abundance that you get, you should be giving. Maybe 10% is a great place to start, but that's not, I don't think, where Christians ought to land in their Christian walk. That's not the final destination. That's just, hey, that's a habit, a discipline that I'm going to start building. And eventually I'm going to build up because God's going to bless me and I'm going to be able to give back to his work, to his ministry. I don't think it's wrong to give, by the way, to charities and you see somebody that's helping the people down in Venezuela, but I don't think that you ought to be giving what you give to God. That should be above and beyond what you're giving to the Lord. In Malachi, it talks about bringing it to the storehouse. I'm just going to say in the New Testament, that idea is bringing it to the local church. Your faithful giving is what allows us to continue the ministry here. And I appreciate the faithfulness of people's giving, but I don't want to just gloss over that and just say, well, you know, some people say I'm tithing to, I think I used the Samaritan's Purse. I think, listen, if you want to help them, help somebody, I want to give most of my giving to the local church. I want to use it for missions and for reaching out with the gospel. But don't use your giving in a way that really deprives God's purpose for it in running the ministry from being able to go forward. By the way, I don't think you should hide your giving from your children. I'm not saying you show them the amounts necessarily, but they should see you put it in the plate, not to be seen, but they need to see the priority that you put on giving. Help them to understand. So really, what you're teaching them is one day God expects you to be able to give back to him a portion of what he's given to you. Some people have this mixed up idea to say, I'm giving God 10% of my income. That's wrong thinking. Better thinking, right thinking is, you know, God is so good to let me keep 90% of what he's given me. Or 85. No, I'm just saying. So remember, when first things are first, then we can get everything else in order. But when first things are last, you cannot get anything else in the right order. So when we talk about first fruits, you say, I've had people ask me, should I give off the gross? Should I give off the net? Should I give off of some other thing? I don't understand either one of those, you know. But I think that first fruits carries the idea before any bills come out, before any of your retirement comes out, you look and say, how has God blessed me? Let me give back from the abundance that he has blessed me with. All right, so we have the right foundation. Oh, we're going to get through all six. I'm zipping through here, right? The right priority, God comes first. The right provision, God has promised to provide food, clothing, and raiment. Is that correct? Absolutely. In 1 Timothy, though, some people can wrongly think, and I don't want to have a straw man argument, but I think sometimes people think God owes it to me, and so I'm going to sit here and wait for him to give it to me. If we're not careful, this entitlement mentality that Christians have towards God that says, I deserve a certain level of living. That's not what's promised here. By the way, what is God's most basic and fundamental way of providing for his children, for his people? Hard work. Through work. 1 Timothy 5:8 says, but if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. And so God's normal channel for provision for a family is work. I mean, that's pretty strong language. Worse than an infidel? But it shows, I think, how seriously God takes man's duty to provide for his house. Paul told the Thessalonians that if any would not work, neither should he eat. That's revolutionary today. If you don't work, you don't eat. Now we have, if you don't work, you get a cell phone, and you get a debit card, and a car ride. Those are anti-biblical, or if I dare say it, that is the spirit of anti-Christ. That is against what God has said. When you incentivize somebody not to work, let me tell you, you are stealing their dignity from them. God has ingrained in mankind to be able to produce, to accomplish, to work, and when you take that away from them, you are stealing something much more than an opportunity to sweat. And I believe God will always make provision for those who cannot. I want you to listen to 2 Thessalonians again, that if any would not work. It does not say could not work. God makes provisions for those that could not, but he has no sympathy for those that would not. Solomon points the sluggard towards an insect to be its teacher. Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise, which, having no guide, no overseer or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. The ant works. The ant, in that sense, is planning ahead. We'll come back to that in a little bit. For the Christian, work in some ways itself is worship. Whatsoever you do, do it heartily. As to what? The Lord. As to the Lord. And not unto men. Colossians 3:23. We need to teach our children that an honest day's labor is a holy thing. It's an honorable thing. So, young people, plug your ears for a minute. Moms, dads, put your kids to work. Give them some jobs around the house, in the yard. I hadn't plugged their ears because I'd rather it come from you than them be mad at me. I believe that a family that honors work will be a family that is rarely in want or need. We have the right foundation. God owns it all. We have the right priority. God comes first. We have the right provision, which is honest, diligent work. Number four is the right spirit. contentment, not covetousness. In Luke 12:15, it says, "And he said unto them, take heed and beware of covetousness. For a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of things which he possesseth." This right here, this thing of covetousness, is where the battle is going to be won or lost in the family. You know what? Covetousness is simply the desire to have more. Covetousness is saying, I cannot be happy without this thing, whatever this thing may be. I think when you crystallize it, more is the whole of the disease in one word. It's not enough. It's never enough. I just need one more thing. Our whole advertising industry is aimed at causing our family to be discontent with God's provision. That's what the billboards, banners on your screen, TV ads, radio ads, constant advertising. And by the way, now that on social media, they've dialed in your gender, one of two, by the way, just free advertisement. They know how old you are. They know your ethnicity. And I say all that to say they are aiming ads right at your front door. They know statistically what's going to move the needle in your life. Do you know how? Again, I don't want to be too much of a conspiracist, but Satan is the orchestrator of the world system. And with all the information that they have, they are advertising to you and to your children in ways that previous generations could have never imagined. Your phone asks you now when you download an app, can they track you? What are they saying? Can we send ads that are relevant, that we think you'll move on because it's so pointed at what we perceive your needs to be? Contentment. It's almost a lost discipline in Christianity, American Christianity. What does God give us as an ointment against this pervasive disease? Well, he gives us 1 Timothy 6:6. But godliness with contentment is great gain. Contentment. Can you be satisfied with what God has given you? The word contentment there in 1 Timothy 6 pictures a soul that is sufficient within itself. It's not dependent on outward circumstances because it is satisfied with God. And having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. In 1 Timothy 6, it goes on and there's a warning, but they that will be rich will fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which, while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. And I think we could go through and have a testimony service of people that we know that were serving the Lord, but they had to make a little bit more money, and they just worked a little bit on Sundays, and eventually, you know what? They're no longer pursuing God. They're pursuing the almighty dollar. You say, oh, that's tragic. I'm going to tell you, we better guard ourselves against that same mentality. Contentment. By the way, did you notice it does not say that money is the root of all evil. It says the love of money. And you can be poor or you can be rich according to the world standards, and both of them can burn for more money equally, regardless of how much they already have or don't have. The writer of Hebrews joins contentment to a promise. In Hebrews 13:5, he says, "Let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have, for he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee." Contentment is not produced by having more. It is produced by having him. Proverbs 15:6 reminds us, better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and trouble therewith. Parents, your children will catch your spirit about the things that you own. If they hear constant murmuring about what we don't have, about how nice things are across the fence on the other side, they're going to grow up covetous. But if you can be thankful, if they hear thanksgiving for what we do have, then you're giving them a leg up to be able to grow up content, thankful for what God has provided. Got 2 points left. And this one's really long, and the next one's not very long. I've got 9 minutes. We're going to go for it, because Bill's going to yell at me later if I don't. Maybe we won't. All right, we said the right spirit. That's contentment, not covetousness. Number 5, I want to talk about capital management. All right, this is more of the practical side, the handling of what God provides. It's possible to believe that God owns it all, to give faithfully, to work hard, to guard the heart, and still have a home that is in financial chaos because no one's managing it very well. Remember what we said stewardship was? House manager? Faithfulness is not only a matter of the heart, okay? It's a matter of administration as well. God's not honored by sloppiness in his house. Do you understand what I'm saying? You can't be careless. 2 disciplines, above all, make or break a family's economy. All right? I'm going to give you both of them. And we're going to go into great detail on both of them. Number 1 is budgeting. Number 2 is debt avoidance. Debt avoidance. Number 1 is budgeting. Counting the cost. Luke 14, 28 through 30 says, "For which of you, intending to build a tower, sitteth not down first and counteth the cost, whether he has sufficient to finish it? Lest haply, after he hath laid the foundation and is not able to finish, all they behold it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish." You know, when you look at that passage from Luke, it shows us that the Lord Jesus assumed budgeting as an ordinary mark of common sense. It was assumed that people would do that. "Which of you," he asked, as if to say, every sensible human being would do this. And he says, "Sitteth down first." Budgeting is deliberate. It doesn't happen by happenstance. Do you know what some people consider budgeting? They have an app or something connected to their credit card, and at the end of the month, they can see where they spent all of their money. Now, tracking your spending is a good thing. I'm not against that. But you can't spend and then figure out your budget at the end of the month for what you should have or shouldn't have spent at the beginning of the month. You can't track your budget if you don't have a budget. Well, we'll get... Don't try to budget on the fly at the checkout counter. That's what I'm trying to say. It doesn't work. He said, "Counteth the cost." That word "counteth" is very, very interesting. It translates really from a root of a pebble. You say, how does "counteth" equal a pebble? The ancient Greeks used a method moving a small pebble, or really several pebbles, across a specialized table called an abax. It was a precursor to the abacus. But those pebbles that they moved is considered counting the cost. In other words, the Lord Jesus is describe a man sitting down and doing the actual arithmetic, pebble by pebble, line by line, before he goes out and he builds. And so a budget is simply counting the cost before you spend rather than after you spend. Notice what's at stake in that parable that he's giving. The testimony. Really, the Lord's name, right? All that behold it began to mock him. An unmanaged Christian home This honors the Lord before a watching world. You know, in agriculture economy, flocks and herds were the family's assets. That was their wealth. And so in Proverbs 27, 23, and 24, we're told to be thou diligent to know the state of thy flocks and look well to thy herds, for riches are not forever. And so God commands us to know what our numbers are. Somebody said, financial management, I have no finances, I don't have any need of management. But you know, God's entrusted something to all of us. In America, we're blessed. I doubt there's even a child in here that doesn't have something in a piggy bank at home. My fear is that people are running their assets. They don't know what they spend within $200 or $300 or $400 in a month. If they were to sit down, they'd be shocked. See, a budget is simply a plan for the family to be able to find margin. Now, margin is just money that is left over after the bills are spent. That doesn't mean that on the budget, it doesn't have a line item. You can go to savings. Maybe you're saving for something specific. Maybe you want to take something and do something special for the missionaries. You know, I'm just going to say, every time I point at missionaries, probably the Hanke family thinks I'm pointing at them or something, but I'm always thinking about those row of missionaries in the back. Whatever it is, but the budget is looking for ways to make sure that you're not only running in the red, meaning you're spending more than what you're making, but to find margin so that you're not spending everything that you're making. You should not need a loan to cover a few $1,000 expense. You shouldn't have to put a crisis on a credit card and end up paying for it twice. The thoughts of the diligent tend only to plenteousness, but of everyone that is hasty, only to want, Proverbs 21:5. Diligent thoughts equal planning, and the unplanned life tends to want. Haste, that's the impulse to purchase. Remember the ant? She provided her meat in the summer. She budgets across the season. By the way, there shouldn't be, when you sit down to budget, my bank account and your bank account. When you get married, you don't have two corporations that are merging. You don't have a his account and hers account. You're one flesh. Everything ought to come together. We don't have my money and her money. We have our money. And I think that biblically, we're not just two people that have not just two corporations, but just in agreement coming together and we're having this business arrangement living together. We're merging our lives together. You say, I can't trust him with the finances. Well, did you know that before you got married? Because it's something you ought to work through to where he becomes trustworthy. I can't trust her. Something's going to have to be done. You are living life together, and you cannot exclude somebody from access to the finances and say that you're sharing your life together. There's a great lack of trust there. That's why finances, before social media came around, was one of the top two reasons that people get a divorce. All right, so number one, we're going to sit down and talk about it. Number two, write down what actually comes in and what actually goes out. It's not complicated. Don't guess at it. Well, I think we got this much, and this is kind of this, and this is, I don't know what we're spending. Maybe you ought to have a spending diary for a month or two. What are you spending on groceries? What are you spending on going out to eat? What are you spending on car maintenance or car bills or whatever it may be? But you ought to have a very accurate list of the money that is going out. Seems to be easier to figure the money coming in. Most people have a pretty steady paycheck if they're not on sales or commission. But we like to guess an awful lot. And it's amazing to me how that we are willing to minimize our faults and we minimize how much we think we're spending. When we write it down, we say, oh, I don't think that can be right. No, I've got the receipts right here. So write down what actually comes in and what actually goes out. Third, give every dollar an assignment before the month begins. You start with God, you go down to the household. I'll say this, when a husband and wife sits down, I tell people in premarital counseling, everything on that is negotiable. I don't care as your pastor, other than faithfully giving so you can develop that discipline. I don't care what you spend your money on. You say, hey, we're going to spend 99% or 85% of our money on eating out. I don't think that's wise. I think it's pretty dumb. But if you both agree and you want to sit in the dark, in the cold, that's up to you two. But everything on that is negotiable until you agree on it. And when it's agreed upon, now marriage is not a contract, but that budget is a covenant right there. That's a contract. You're saying, I'm not going to spend money outside of that agreement unless we have a budget committee meeting. Now, sometimes something breaks or something, whatever, and you have to, and maybe if you're just getting started on budgeting, you realize we should not have said 85%. We really would like to turn the heat on in the middle of January. So we better put some money aside for heat. So you might have to have a budget committee meeting. But it's not one person that's in charge of all the finances and the other person has no idea what's going on. How many times have you seen somebody that's been married for 50 or 60 years and the spouse dies and the one that's remaining is like, I don't even know where the checkbook is. Listen, that should not be so. That finances are part of our life. We share everything in every part of our life. And so that doesn't mean that both of you are cutting checks at the same time for the same things. But y'all both should know where things are and who is owed what and what the budget is. It's not just Missy giving me a sheet of paper and saying, hey, this is the spending for this month, buddy. Or me handing this to her and say, hey, we're curbing some things that you used to do until I'm able to do those things that I want to do. That's not it. You sit down and you talk about it. You work through it. I think some people think they're too sophisticated for a budget. You know, when I talk to those people, they're never getting ahead. They're struggling. And then fourthly, review it together. Not with accusation, okay? You're not using it as a cudgel against your spouse. The budget, I can't overemphasize how important a budget is. You'll never be able to save up anything as long as you let it leak out. All right, secondly, debt avoidance. I'm going to scream through it. Proverbs 22:7, the rich rule over the poor and the borrower is servant to the lender. To me, this is the other side of the same coin. You have to budget, but you also have to avoid debt if you're going to create a margin, if you're going to be able to save up money, if you're going to be able to put something away. Now, I don't think the Bible ever calls borrowing money a sin. I don't see that, but it never once speaks well of it. It doesn't say, hey, this is a great idea. But I don't see it condemning it completely. It speaks of it in the way that you would speak of a yoke. The borrower is servant to the lender. And that word servant is the ordinary word used for slave in the Bible. Every debt a family takes on sells one piece of its future to someone else. The man in debt, the woman in debt, does not fully own their paycheck on the day they receive it. Someone else has first claim. That first, it might be Sears and Roebuck. Probably not anymore, though, right? Sears card, I was thinking that. Sears card was my first credit card. And they were hard to get back then. Now they're really hard to get. I think a family that will not say no to debt will ultimately not be able to say yes to God because its future has already been mortgaged. How many men have not been able to answer a call to serve, to give, to change course as God directs because the payments would not allow it? Debt does not just borrow money, it borrows your freedom. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous showeth mercy and giveth. If you do borrow money, your testimony is on the line. You must pay back on time what you owe. An unpaid bill in your name is really a blight on your Savior's name. Proverbs 22:26-27 say, be thou not one of them that strike hands, or of them that are sureties for debts. If thou hast nothing to pay, why should he take away thy bed from under thee? And to strike hands just has the idea of to shake on another man's loan. And so what he's saying is, don't be a co-signer. We would use that phraseology today. Don't co-sign on somebody else's loan. And your kid comes up and says, boy, dad, you know, I just can't get a car unless you co-sign on this thing. I'm not doing it. Haley, don't give me those eyes. I might do it. You can't co-sign and take somebody else's loan unless you're willing to pay it off for them, because you just may find out you're responsible for that loan. Where does debt come from? I think really if you trace it back, it comes from two roots. Number one, we already mentioned covetousness. I'm not satisfied. I've got to have it. This is going to make me happy, wanting more than God has provided. Number two, haste, the refusal to sit down and count. Another way to word that would be convenience. I'm lazy. I've not done my budget. I don't care. And I just want it. And it's convenience. Right here, I'm going to do it. I didn't write down who said this. This is a quote. Debt is what happens when a family's wants outrun God's provision and the family follows its wants. That's why debt is ultimately a spiritual problem long before it is ever a mathematical problem. It's a quiet vote of no confidence in Matthew 6:33. It's a way of adding to ourselves the things that God has not yet added. All right, practically then, number one, do not buy no ordinary thing on credit that depreciates while you're still paying for it. If you can't pay for it, then it might be a good sign that God has not yet provided for it. You know how you can tell? Your budget is going to tell you whether or not you can afford that. Number two, if your family is currently in debt, don't despair, but attack it. Get serious about it. Start knocking it out. Get rid of it. Name every debt on paper. First thing you have to do, though, is stop digging your hole. Then you can start working your way out of that hole. I think that the discipline that people learn on the way out of debt is the discipline that God wants all of us to have in managing our money. Have you ever known somebody that got out of debt? They say, praise the Lord, and then you see him driving a new car down the road. I'm not saying cars are sinful, but I'm saying let's rein in what is a need and what is a want. Number three, build the reserve of Proverbs 21:20 that we talked about earlier. The emergency fund, the emergency that once drove you to put something on credit should be covered by the margin that you've gained from your budget. And so you should have an emergency fund. You shouldn't have to get a loan in order to replace a transmission on your vehicle or a new washer when it dies. Those are emergencies. But you ought to have some kind of sufficient fund that's going to take care of those things. I know it's hard sometimes to get ahead, but what you don't want to do is to be so razor thin on your margins that one of those things are going to cause you to have to put it on put it on credit. Because all you're going to do is pay for it for the next couple of years. I'm sure I've given this illustration before. I have an uncle. I love him. He was in our wedding. And unfortunately, his wife left him, and he was sorting out the bills one day. And talking about Sears credit card, he had bought some tools or something when he built his house some 13 or 14 years earlier. and she had been making minimum monthly payments on that. I mean, he probably paid the balance of that two or three times, and just throwing money away because of the interest on that debt. Every time that you put it on a credit card or put it on debt, you are really paying more for it than what you would have if you just had the margin to be able to cover it. Have an emergency fund. Fourth, teach your young people before they leave your roof that the borrower is slave to the lender. The lenders are going to be waiting for them. They're going to be getting credit card advertising, I would say as soon as they turn 18, but I think it starts coming before then. They have their number just like they have your number. Teach them wisdom. We don't have time for it tonight, but I'll give you number six, the right legacy, generosity, and leaving an inheritance. A good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children, and the wealth of sinners is laid up for the just, Proverbs 13, 22. I know if I sat down with 99% of you, you all would say, I've got my finances in hand. We are all experts in our finances, in our own eyes. But I'm asking you to take an objective look for the truths that I've shared with you. Are you struggling month to month? Are you falling behind? Do you have an insatiable need for the next new thing in your life? And you find that it's breaking your bank account? I'm just asking you to be honest with yourself. Look at the empirical data. Do you have a budget? Are you living to that budget? Are both of you involved with that budget? God owns it all. He's just calling us to be managers. Be a good asset manager that he can trust. And I believe if you'll be a good asset manager, you may find that he trusts you with something more. In that verse, just very quickly, let me just take a last minute. Do you know what he calls money? The least of things. And if you can't handle the least of these, how are you going to handle the souls of others? How are you going to handle the well-being of others? Be a good manager of the least and let him bless you with more responsibility. Let's pray. With your heads bowed, your eyes closed. You've listened well.